Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today's episode tackles one of the defining environmental stories, not just of California, but of the modern world. How Los Angeles went from choking on smog to becoming a global model for air pollution control, and what that history can teach us about climate change today. I'm joined by Ann Carlson of UCLA Law School, one of the leading scholars in environmental law, and a former official in the Biden administration's transportation policy world. We talk about her new book, Smog and Sunshine, which tells a story that I think a lot of us have forgotten, that government, science, and public pressure actually worked. Over decades, California didn't just reduce pollution, it fundamentally transformed how we think about environmental regulation. In this conversation, we get into the evolution of environmental law, the role of California as a policy innovator, the messy and contested path from denial and delay to real change. We also talk about catalytic converters, the politics of regulation, environmental justice in places like the Inland Empire, and the tension between optimism and doom in environmental storytelling. If you've ever wondered whether large-scale policy solutions actually work, or what history can tell us about tackling climate change, this is a conversation worth listening to. Let's go meet Ann Carlson. Start by talking about environmental law for a minute here. We're going to dig into the details of your book in a bit, but it's evolved substantially since the 1990s. We've seen a kind of evolution from a more kind of command and control model with EPA setting limits and attempting to enforce compliance to a world of heavy litigation, but also driven by climate science. I'd be curious for you to talk about the changes that you've seen over the course of your career and whether these changes to how environmental law is operated have been an overall net positive for outcomes.
Sure. Let me give you three ways in which I think environmental law has changed pretty dramatically over the course of my career. I would start with the fact that we no longer have bipartisan support for environmental law. That really has changed since 1990, when George H.W. Bush passed very substantial amendments to the Clean Air Act. George W. Bush actually ran on a platform of addressing climate change. But shortly thereafter, the Republican Party really shifted away from even acknowledging the existence of climate change, let alone trying to regulate it. So that's a really big change, and that is for the worse. There is no question that is a negative. It has made it very difficult for us to address what I think is the biggest environmental existential threat we've ever faced, and that's climate change. The second big change is the heavy emphasis on federal agencies to issue rules and regulations to regulate, particularly climate change and vehicle emissions through the CAFE standards, which are the fuel economy standards issued by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which I used to head. That a lot of the work being done is at the agency level because Congress hasn't acted. And when Congress doesn't act, we're left using statutes that in many respects are old or don't necessarily address the problem in the best way. Not positive. And then the third big change that I think is really a big positive is states stepping up to regulate and to address particularly climate change in the face of federal inaction. And that's particularly true when we don't have a Democrat in office. California is the obvious leader here. California's always been a leader on vehicle emissions, but it's done much more than that on climate change. It has a big, what's called a cap and invest program that affects stationary sources. Sorry, I just over there because I just got a phone call. It affects, so California has been regulating far more than just vehicles. It's been regulating power plants, fuels, all sorts of things that affect the climate and that emit greenhouse gases. That is a positive. And it's a positive in part because when the federal government retreats, there have been a number of states willing to step in. And California is not the only one. Colorado, New York, Washington, Oregon, and others.
Okay. We're going to dig back into some discussions around current issues in a little bit towards the end of the conversation. But I want to jump for a second to talking about your work in the administrative world. In addition to your work in the academy, you've also worked in an administrative capacity during the Biden-Harris administration, which you just mentioned. I'm curious how that changed your perspective on the ways you conduct and think about research.
That's a really great question. Part of what working in the administration, first as the chief counsel and then the acting administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, is that it really gave me a bird's eye view into the regulatory process. NHTSA is a heavily rulemaking oriented agency. I think we're second or third to the Environmental Protection Agency. We issued rules not only about fuel economy, which was the reason that I worked there, but also a number of very important rules on safety. And so it gave me an understanding of how the administrative process works, what works well, what doesn't work so well. And that's been really important in upcoming research I'm doing. It also gave me a really in-depth understanding of vehicle safety issues. I've worked on environmental issues my entire career. When I started at NHTSA, we were facing an incredible crisis on our roadways because COVID had led to less driving, but paradoxically, an increase in fatalities. And that was not true in any other country. It was really just true in the United States. And so we immediately adopted a bunch of different measures for addressing it. And one of the things that it really showed me is that while regulations are great, they take a long time to take effect. And so let's take environmental regulations. If you regulate greenhouse gases coming out of vehicles, they only affect the model years that are forthcoming, and usually there's lead time of anywhere from 18 months to a little bit longer. And that doesn't affect existing vehicles, or it doesn't affect existing power plants. There are some ways that you can get around that, but it made me really sensitive to the fact that if you want to make an immediate difference, you have to think about a range of tools. I think Congress did that with the Inflation Reduction Act. That was a statute that provided tons of tax incentives, grant programs, loan programs to get money into the field immediately to try to drive down greenhouse gases quickly, as opposed to waiting for the administrative process to kick in and take effect.
That makes sense. Thinking in the kind of praxis terms of how, what does this look like once it leaves the academy and enters the bureaucracy, I'm sure added multiple dimensions. I want to talk now about the research in your book. In perusing your CV and looking at some of your previous publications, it's mostly legal writing in your career, which makes sense with your profession. But you're entering into kind of a more interdisciplinary work here with Smog and Sunshine. And I had a couple questions about that. Legal writing and historical writing have a lot of common elements, but there are some distinct differences, both in kind of approach to source material and also argumentation. What were, you think, the biggest differences with your approach to Smog and Sunshine versus your academic legal writing in the past? What did you notice in writing a new style monograph, if you will?
There were a few things that I noticed. The first was that there was something liberating about being able to shape a narrative that didn't have to comport with all of the kind of strange norms that legal law review articles comport to. So, for example, if I'm writing a law review article, I'm thinking about any way in which the argument might be taken apart and what the objections are. Those are important in the kind of writing that I was doing with Smog and Sunshine, but I was really trying to compel the reader to come along with me on the ride and to figure out the another thing that was really liberating was that I thought I could concentrate not so much on the entire chronological story, but on a story that was interesting and would again grab the reader, some of which is chronological, but some of which is not. And that was liberating. I don't know that I always write that way in a than a law review article, but it felt very different. And then I wasn't necessarily making legal arguments. I was really trying to tell a story about the success of government, the success of individuals who had really been instrumental in the cleanup of Los Angeles's air. And again, just create a narrative for an audience that would carry them along with me in telling the story.
Did you use certain models or examples of environmental history writing? Donald Worcester, for example, Rivers of Empire is a great kind of historical argument about the way rivers evolved and their connection to capitalism and industry. Were there certain kind of like writers or examples that you pulled from that were leading lights for you?
Yeah, I think Elizabeth Colbert's work is probably the most influential to me because she manages both to amass an extraordinary amount of knowledge, but also use that information to tell stories that are gripping and that have narrative power. Hmm. And she does it both in short form in a magazine and then also in the books that she's written.
When I look at the field or the genre of environmental writing, I notice some patterns. One is that, and there's this term called mood affiliation, where people kind of gravitate towards subject matter based on their mood or their temperament. And if I would say about environmental writing, it can be pretty negative, obviously,
yes,
with everything that we learn about extinction and pollutants, and just it goes on and on. It's success stories are rare in the genre. And so I'm curious, what were your kind of thoughts about broaching a subject, but approaching it from that kind of other lens of accounting for accomplishments?
I get really discouraged at the way in which we beat up on government. Government has become the whipping boy for so many politicians. We're told a story repeatedly that government doesn't solve our problems. Ronald Reagan famously said, government is the problem, not the solution. In the environmental context, it's not true. Without government, we wouldn't have cleaner air. We wouldn't have cleaner water. And I thought that story needed to be told. And I frankly think at a time where the attacks on government are so overwhelming and the pervasiveness of a very negative feeling about, for me at least, about what's happening to our country, it was important to tell another story. And that story is one thing that's important about it is it's not a snapshot of one moment in time. It's multi-decadal. It has taken us 70 years to clean up our air. We're not done yet, but we've had many good stories about how we've accomplished that. I guess the final reason that I wrote it is really the way I opened the book, and that is that a number of people, I can't tell you how many times people have said to me that Los Angeles has terrible air quality. And I grew up in Southern California. I was born in 1960 in Orange County. I lived through the worst decades of Southern California pollution. And I know that our air pollution is not what it was. And yet that history seems to be forgotten. And I think people should know and should be inspired by the fact that we have not fully, but very, very aggressively solved a major environmental problem that, again, took decades to do. It's exactly what we need to do with respect to climate change. I try to be optimistic about climate change stories, too. There are a number of them. But again, we tend to focus on the negative. And I think that doesn't motivate people to actually act in the way that we need to act if we're going to solve these problems.
Yeah, I've often speculated as to the reasons. I understand at a kind of a pure existential threat reason why negative journalism or publications tend to orient that way. But I also wondered if it was, like you were saying, some historical illiteracy or amnesia about like how bad things were. If you just take timestamps on periods and then you can measure how far you have to go, it can feel like there's a new mountain every day. But I don't think that really does justice to the people that worked in the past to make the improvements to where we got now. And so it can be frustrating in reading this kind of stuff, particularly the stuff that is exclusively doom and gloom and nothing positive is happening. And I see that a lot, and I hope it changes. So let's jump into your book for that, to dig into that more. And I want to start by talking about LA, a place that I was also born. I was born in Anaheim.
Born in Fullerton, so there we
Okay,
go.
down the road from each other. So there's been a lot of popular narratives of Los Angeles's environmental history. When you were looking at the extant publications out there, what did you learn popularly about what people thought? You gestured at that a second ago by saying some people say bad air quality, but I'd like you to dig into more just the popular consciousness around the subject.
They're pretty dystopian books about Los Angeles. City of Ports is one. There's a book written in 2008, Smog Town, that's a pretty pessimistic account of what Los Angeles had or had not accomplished, and an indictment of people who live in Los Angeles as being unwilling to change their behavior in order to solve this terrible air pollution problem. So, again, I think part of the, and there are many others, there are great books about Los Angeles and particular slices of Los Angeles. Bill Boyarsky has written a great book about the importance of the Chandlers, the owners and publishers of the Los Angeles Times. There's a terrific book by Jeff Cowan about Clarence Darrow. It also involves the Times and the bombing of the Los Angeles Times, which was extraordinarily anti-union. There are many great books. I haven't found a book that really tells the story that I'm trying to tell. I wouldn't have written it if I had. I mean, I found myself surprised that we are centrally defined in many respects by smog. It is a word that continues to be associated with Los Angeles. When people think about Los Angeles, it's Hollywood and palm trees and sunshine, but it's also smog. And that has just struck me as so fundamentally unfair given what we've accomplished. And again, I just felt this need to tell the story.
Yeah, I lived in Pasadena for a number of years, and I would always wait for those days where you'd have clarity on the hills behind you. Sometimes they would go into hiding for what felt like months. It probably wasn't.
Certainly
But
weeks, certainly
yeah,
months.
there was times where you're like, where am I? Because it creates this kind of sense of alienation from the landscape where
Exactly.
you kind of lose your markers and your touchstones for where you are, and you're just in this abyss. I remember this reading this book by this a British philosopher that came to LA to write a book about something ethics related. He ended up writing about nihilism and being up at night eating tacos and not sure where he was, which is a feeling I'm sure if you've lived in LA, you've had at one point.
Let me give you a statistic to solidify your sense that it sometimes felt like months. So in the 1960s and 70s, we measured visibility days. And that's really a proxy for a particular pollutant, PM2.5, which are these tiny particles of pollution. They can be comprised of dust or toxic materials, and they're incredibly deadly, because they burrow into your lungs and can cause all sorts of problems, respiratory problems, heart problems, cancer problems. We didn't actually start monitoring and measuring PM2.5 and regulating it until 1997. But in the 60s and 70s, as I said, we monitored visibility. And for more than half the year, almost all of those years, you couldn't see more than 3 miles. So you're not wrong to think months and months went by and you couldn't see the mountains. I have a friend who owns a house probably 3 miles south of the Hollywood sign. For the first 10 years in which she lived in that house, she didn't know she had a view of the Hollywood sign. Today, you can see it every day. The idea that 3 miles is not far, and for more than half the year, that's how terrible the visibility was in Southern California.
Yeah, it doesn't help that Los Angeles is a major transient city where people are moving in and out. So that kind of placidness, or whatever you'd call it, of knowing a specific environmental location super well is complicated because people are always moving in and out of a major metropolitan area.
It's also why I think people don't know the history of smog, because if you get here in 2010, you didn't experience the same kind of smog that people in the 1980s were breathing.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's jump into your book and the structure. I always like to start with table of contents and the structure of the book. When I used to teach classes on the subject, I would remind students that the structure of the book tells you as much about the meaning of the book as the actual content, how it's laid out. And so when I looked at your structure, it seemed like it followed a pretty clear linear path, which was a kind of a problem, a diagnosis, a policy, and lessons. And one assumption that I'm taking from your structure is that the argument is moving beyond narrative to a focus on history as precedent. Is that an
Yes.
accurate way to describe what you're doing here?
I think it is. So I'll tell you what I think I'm doing in the table of contents. So the first seven chapters are largely chronological. And so they take us up through the 1970s. And then I tackle what I think of as major problems that we also needed to address, not necessarily in chronological order. So, for example, there's a whole chapter on environmental injustice, I call it, and the sources of pollution that have disproportionately affected low-income communities of color. There's a whole chapter on Dieselgate, which is the VW diesel scandal. But there was another one related to that had to do with diesel trucks that used the very same cheating device that VW used. But I do spend an entire chapter trying to lay out what I think the lessons are that we can take from our fight to clean up Los Angeles's air to fight climate change. And I think there are some important lessons. So I absolutely had in mind, this is not just a story I want to tell, but it's a story I want to tell because we are facing the greatest environmental challenge we've ever faced. And we should look to our history to figure out what we've learned in fighting another major pollution problem and how we can use those lessons to address the current situation.
A second theme that I noticed in your book is around institutions, and we can sub in institutions for government here for a moment. And it's my take from your book that essentially what you're, in broad strokes, what you're arguing is that institutions are the primary agents in producing outcomes, at least environmental outcomes. Would you agree with that take on your work?
Yes, but there are a bunch of other players who influence those
Okay.
institutions.
Okay.
Let me name three of them. One is the media. The LA Times plays an incredibly important role early on in pushing government to act. Another are community organizations. I focus on two. There are others. There's an organization called Stamp Out Smog that was started by basically the ladies of Hollywood, women married to important Hollywood moguls, who really very sophisticatedly mobilized all sorts of groups to put public pressure on those institutions. And the third are scientists. I think scientists play a really important role. I guess I should not diminish the role of lawyers either. And in particular, lawyers file lawsuits to get government to act. So these institutions don't operate in a vacuum. That's one of the lessons, I think, for climate change. All these other players matter in whether the institutions respond and how they respond.
Okay. And when you think about the stakeholders, and if I were to think about, so you view the stakeholders as all influencing government, then government channels that energy to produce outcomes. I'm just thinking, I'm charting this in my head to understand how you see the system flowing, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Okay. The other thing that came up for me was public choice theory, which is an interesting kind of, it's part of libertarian kind of thinking and how to think about government. And I think there are elements that align with your thinking and elements that don't. Obviously, public choice theory is pretty pessimistic about government's ability to create change. It's where we get the kind of ideas of regulatory capture. So where do you think you line up vis-a-vis public choice theory? And obviously, you're doing something quite a bit more empirical and less abstract, but I'm curious for you to explicate the difference there.
Sure. So environmental policy is actually one of the great puzzles for public choice theory, because one would assume that this disparate mass of people who care about the issue don't have the organizational incentives, the financial incentives, and so forth to influence policymakers. They're instead influenced by moneyed interests who are concentrated, who have all the incentive in the world to put pressure on elected officials to behave in ways that are consistent with their interests. And so, to begin with, the passage of the Clean Air Act seems to belie public choice theory. That isn't to say that we haven't seen interest groups, particularly the oil industry and the auto industry, wield a lot of power, but that power can be overcome. And so, I am a believer that when there is sufficient public pressure, and that public pressure can come in a lot of different forms, combined with pressure from lawsuits and so forth, that the tendency of elected officials to respond to moneyed interests can be overcome. I should say, however, that money is a different instrument these days because of some Supreme Court opinions. So the amount of money now being wielded in politics is, I think, so distorting that I'm not even sure public choice is the right terminology
Late
anymore.
capitalism, maybe.
Yeah, and those the oligarchical overtaking of some of our government institutions, the influence of billionaires. We didn't think about billionaires when public choice theory was first proposed. And let me say one other thing, and that is I worked in an agency that regulated the auto industry, and I saw no evidence of agency capture by the civil servants I worked with. In fact, I think the biggest secret of Washington, D.C. is the extraordinary talent in the civil service workforce. And that, right now, of course, that civil service is under assault. There is this perpetual kind of shaming of public servants as somehow a part of a deep state. That was not my experience at all. In fact, I can tell you that with most of the public servants I worked with, I did not know their politics. And I have many examples of those public servants serving with distinction when Trump was president the first time, and then turning around and helping the political appointees in the Biden-Harris administration carry out our responsibilities. And now some of those same people are doing the same in the second version of the Trump administration, not in a legal way, but in a way that is consistent with their obligations as federal employees.
Yeah, and on that note, if people are interested in digging into that, I thought Michael Lewis's kind of compilation of vignettes of various public servants was fantastic because it humanized people that have been dehumanized
Correct.
over the past few years. And there's some great stories in there. I think my favorite one was about the guy that manages the national memorials at the cemeteries and.
Yeah, it's a great book, and it's exactly what we need to counter the kind of faceless bureaucrat image that so often gets put out into the public sphere.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about cars now. I can't even count the number of books that have been on this podcast about LA and cars, but yours is very specific. And I wanted to ask you, this is annoying, but I wanted to ask you something outside the scope of the book because you were focused on cars. And I've done a number of conversations about deindustrialization on the West Coast after World War II. In your research for the book, did you look at deindustrialization and land use and zoning as other factors that contributed to the decline of smog and emissions as well?
Yes and no. One thing I will say is that Southern California actually did a very good job at a time when it was an industrial powerhouse, really beginning with World War II, of regulating the sources of pollution that were industrial way before everybody else did. And that was, in fact, the focus a lot of the regulation because that's what people thought was the cause of the smog. So there's no question that transportation has been the dominant source of pollution in Southern California. It continues to be the dominant source. Different sources of transportation, for example, rail is a source. The big ships that come into the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach are a big source. Heavy-duty diesel trucks are a big source. For a long time, cars alone were far and away the single biggest source. As LA has become less of an industrial center, we've still seen smog issues.
Yeah.
So it's hard to really point to deindustrialization as a positive force in cleaning up the environment. What we've really done is clean up our vehicles. And we
Yeah.
have a ways to go there. They're not all cleaned up. We still have, so for example, ships and airplanes and trains are regulated at the federal level, not at the state level. So California has very little power over those sources of pollution, and yet they're very important in polluting our air.
Let's talk about the problem, which was smog. And I want to ask you about distribution. The LA basin is massive. Were there pockets or worse areas, or was it fairly uniformly distributed, the smog across the basin?
The smog is not distributed. Today, it's not distributed in the evenly, and it never has been. So the basin, as you say, is massive. And the basin that's considered for regulatory purposes is set up because it's geographically consistent with the way in which the smog accumulates and where it accumulates. So if Southern California, you know that it's ringed on three sides by mountains, and then of course it's got the coast. Those mountains form a bowl. And the bowl traps smog along with an inversion layer that traps smog underneath it. But there are a couple of other things that are important. One is that the winds are very weak in Southern California. And when they blow the smog from the west to the east. And the east is the Inland Empire, it's San Bernardino and Riverside. And so basically, as you go up against the mountains, the smog gets worse. You talked about Pasadena. The San Fernando Valley had much worse smog than the west side of Los Angeles. And Riverside and San Bernardino had and continue to have the worst air quality in the basin. It's sufficiently different that if you were just monitoring the air quality in the city of Los Angeles, you'd have very few days that continue to violate federal standards, a handful of days. Most days of the year, Central Los Angeles, West Los Angeles do not violate any pollution standards. When I'm saying most days, I'm thinking 360 days out of the year. But when you get out to Riverside and San Bernardino, we still have an ozone problem. And those areas are the ones that experience the ozone, although at much, much lower levels than what was happening in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
As you say this, there's a gas blower outside the office window. Perfectly timed.
We're regulating those.
Let's talk about equity here. When I think about smog pushing to the Inland Empire, San Bernardino, I think about equity issues. Can you
Yes.
dig through that?
So there's more than one equity issue about smog in Southern California. Historically, one is that, as I've already said, the smog accumulates in Riverside and San Bernardino. Riverside and San Bernardino have median incomes that are lower than much of the rest of the basin, and increasingly they are populated with people of color, predominantly Latino. So that's one equity issue. And it's one that the Clean Air Act wasn't really set up to deal with because we measure what's known as ambient air, basically background air in the basin. And if the basin violates a standard, then the whole basin is considered to be out of compliance, even though the smog may accumulate in one particular part. But the other distributional concern really didn't come to fore until the 1980s with a group called Mothers of East LA. And Mothers of East LA was fighting first against the location of a prison in East Los Angeles, but what it really became famous for was stopping the building of an incinerator. It was a garbage incinerator that was going to be built in East LA. And the impetus behind the Mothers of East LA was because East LA had been a dumping ground for all kinds of environmental harms. And we hadn't really regulated thinking about where are pollution sources located, as opposed to this, again, this kind of background idea, we got to reduce smog for everybody. But of course, reducing smog for everybody still leaves what we call hotspots in air pollution terminology. The biggest one is living near freeways. Of course, the closer you are to freeway, the cheaper the housing is. So there's absolutely an economic explanation and problem. So lower income people are much more likely to live near heavily trafficked roadways. We also see heavy pollution near the oil refineries in the Wilmington area and the port. Wilmington gets both. It gets pollution both from the ports and from the oil refineries. We see increasingly air pollution from the heavy diesel trucks that bring the goods from the ports that come in from Asia into warehouses in the Inland Empire. The rate of growth of warehouses in the Inland Empire is astonishing. I think Amazon has more than 40 warehouses and they're massive. And the warehouses themselves are not pollution sources, but they draw to them trucks and trains that are pollution sources. So all of these distributional issues remain today. They remain, in my view, our single biggest air pollution problem. I don't want to get away from the fact that we've done extraordinary things in reducing air pollution, and that has benefited everybody. We can talk about lead, which is, in some respects, perhaps the distributional pollutant that has been most problematic and that we've largely eliminated from the atmosphere. But we do have remaining issues, and those remaining issues tend to be to produce distributional concerns, environmental justice concerns, because of the location of where people live in relationship to the remaining polluting sources.
I think this is a good time to transition to talking about the past. And I want to start with the Tucker Report, which was something I wasn't as familiar with before reading your book. I would love for you to unpack what it was and then
Sure.
the reception and impact that it had on Los Angeles.
Sure. You can't talk about the Tucker Report without talking about the power of the Los Angeles Times. And this is in the 1950s. And the LA Times, Bill Boyarsky has a book about the Chandlers and just how extraordinarily powerful they were. Those are the publishers of the Times. They were involved in virtually every major economic activity in Los Angeles, including bringing McDonnell Douglas to Southern California, developing real estate in the San Fernando Valley, developing Hollywood Land, a real estate development that is now famous for having the Hollywood sign in it. You name it, they were involved in it. And their paper was the paper of record, and it was extraordinarily influential. And one of the things that happened at the Los Angeles Times is that the wife of the then publisher, Dorothy Chandler, of the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, that's named for her. She's also of the Buffums family. If you grew up in Southern California, Buffums was a department store. Dorothy Chandler implored her husband to do something to pressure politicians to do something about smog. And one of the things the Times did is it hired a full-time smog editor whose entire focus was on air pollution. The amount of ink spilled on smog in the Los Angeles Times was extraordinary. And then the other thing the LA Times did is it hired this guy named Raymond Tucker. And Raymond Tucker was hired to study Los Angeles air pollution and tell the county and city what we should do about it. And he was hired because he was a scientist on the faculty of Washington University in St. Louis. And he had tackled St. Louis smog. And he had done so very successfully by cleaning up coal-fired power plants in St. Louis, getting them to switch the kind of coal they used and beginning to monitor their emissions. And it had been very effective. And so the Times thought that bringing in Tucker would be a great idea, and he produced a report. He spent 3 weeks in Los Angeles. As he reported, there were no smoggy days when he was there because it was December, which is one of our least smoggy months. And he spent all this time doing things like climbing into boilers and looking at all the sources of what he thought were the sources of pollution in Southern California. And he made recommendations in a big report that was published. A headline above the fold in the Los Angeles Times touted the findings of the report. And he basically said, do what I did in St. Louis, and you should do a couple of other things. You should also get rid of backyard garbage burning. So if you own a house in Southern California that is older than the 1950s, it either has or had a backyard incinerator in it where people burned their garbage.
That is
Turns out
wild.
it's wild. And Los Angeles, little known fact, was the last major city in the country to have public garbage pickup because we burned all our garbage. So he said, you got to stop the backyard garbage burning. You have to stop farmers from using citrus pots, these pots that warmed their citrus groves in order to stave off frost that would destroy the fruit. So he told LA to do all these things, and LA did all these things, but he did something else. He exonerated cars. He said, they just aren't the source of pollution that people might think they are. You don't really need to worry about cars. And that was just flat out wrong. Cars were the major source of pollution. And not only were they the major source, but as LA's population grew, so did the numbers of cars. And as if you look at LA population growth from the 1920s to the 1990s, it was extraordinary. We went from like 200,000 people to 4 million people. And
Now
with those people came cars.
that rhetoric is still present. There's where I live in the Central Valley, there's a clean air advisory board that regularly plays commercials on local television saying, and they mentioned that they've reduced air pollution by getting rid of pellet stoves and having burn days. And cars are not mentioned, obviously, because logistics and distribution is a major part of the economy around here. But it's, yeah, the same playbook is still at work.
Yeah,
Absolutely.
I would say the big shift to the Central Valley now is trucks are a huge source of pollution. Cars are so much cleaner than they used to be that, for example, in Southern California, they're only responsible for about 5% of the pollution. They used to be the dominant source.
Yeah. Let's jump to the reception and the impact of the Tucker Report, if you could talk about that.
So one of the things that happens is that the LA air pollution district that has been created to attack smog doesn't look at cars, because Tucker has told them they don't need to, and in fact is quite responsible and follows all of his recommendations. And lo and behold, smog doesn't stop. It just keeps growing. I should add that, for example, the president of Caltech agreed with Tucker. saying, oh, cars are not the right place to be looking. There are all these other sources, and if we just clean those up, our smog problem will go away. And so the scientific community isn't looking at smog, and the regulatory community stops at cars, rather, and the regulatory community stops looking at cars. So we probably lose, I don't know, 5 to 8 years in identifying the major culprit of Los Angeles smog.
A big theme in your book is California leading the way. California is a laboratory for change. Can you unpack what that means exactly? And what does it mean to lead, if you will? That's an interpretive statement, but what does that look like in practice? And maybe you could use catalytic converters as like a good example of this.
Sure. So the leadership starts early. Los Angeles County has the most extensive pollution monitoring system of any city in the world very early on, starting in the 1940s and 50s. We start regulating sources of pollution that other jurisdictions don't. And then in 1960, the state gets involved and sets up what is the precursor to today's California Air Resources Board and issues the first emission standards for vehicles in the country. But what really sets California apart is a funny little amendment in amendments to the Clean Air Act in 1966 that designate California as the only state in the country that doesn't have to follow federal emission standards. California can set its own standards as long as those standards are stronger than the federal standards. And so we get this kind of imprimatur from the federal government, and that's because of the quality of Los Angeles air, also because of intense political pressure that Californians put on Congress not to prohibit California from regulating. And then we get to the catalytic converter. And the catalytic converter is a really complicated story. It's sometimes said that the catalytic converter is the result of the Clean Air Act amendments of 1970, which required it. That's not true. Clean Air Act doesn't require any particular technology. What the Clean Air Act did is it told car manufacturers in 1970 that by 1975, they had to cut pollutants from vehicles by 90%. It's actually 1976 for one pollutant, and the rest for 1975. Lee Iacocca, the famous, infamous president of Ford Motor Company, basically said that Ford would stop manufacturing cars if Congress adopted that standard. It went ahead and did so anyway, and guess what? Ford continued to manufacture cars. But that was an extraordinarily strong standard.
The
and
tactic has been used for so long. That tactic, we're going to leave, the threat we're going to stop manufacturing.
Yep.
I understand some basic economics. I understand the concept of physical plants and fixed costs. There's only so much you can leave, if you will.
There's a larger story about the car industry actually conspiring to keep emissions technology off the market. And in the 1950s, there had been a rudimentary catalytic converter that was invented, and the car companies basically ignored it. They denied that their product had anything to do with smog. Then they delayed doing anything about it. And finally, they engaged in a conspiracy. They actually settled a big federal conspiracy case because they collectively got together and refused to issue emissions control technology. So along comes the Clean Air Act. They've got this incredibly tight deadline, and they do two things. The private sector starts working hard to try to meet the standards, and then they also sue, which is a story about the Clean Air Act that continues throughout its history. And they sue and succeed in getting the standards delayed. And what they don't count on is the incredible resolve of the first EPA administrator, William Ruckelshaus, is, of course, much more famous for refusing to fire Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor for Watergate. But he's also exhibits this incredible resolve as the first administrator of EPA, because even though he can't require the auto manufacturers to meet the standards by 1975, because he's under a court order, he can give California permission to move forward. And California decides that it's going to, if the federal government won't lead, it's going to step in and it's going to issue really stringent standards. But it can't do so without getting permission from EPA. And Ruckelshaus is under this enormous pressure to turn down California's application. It's called a waiver. But he doesn't. And he lets California go forward. And he basically says, we're going to let California be the guinea pig. There's lots of concern that catalytic technology is not going to be ready for prime time. It's going to be installed on 10 million new cars. It may actually reduced fuel economy. There are all sorts of horror stories. It might not last for very long. Consumers may get extremely angry about it. And California says, we're going to go ahead anyway. And the state goes ahead again with the blessing of Ruckelshaus. And by 1976, we begin to see widespread adoption of catalytic converters in California. And the result is that air pollution really starts to improve. Ultimately, Congress extends the deadline for the rest of the country. But by 1981, catalytic technology is standard across the country, and it has saved hundreds of thousands of lives. It cut air pollution really dramatically. It has extended around the world, and we have the Environmental Protection Agency, California, and the Clean Air Act really to thank for that.
Let's jump. There's many other historical vignettes I could dig into, but we're about 45 minutes in, and I've got some kind of broader 20,000-foot questions. So when you're thinking about lessons from this book for different stakeholders, and I'd be curious, activists relative to the civil servants that we've discussed at a different point in this conversation, what do you think are some of the lessons for some of the different stakeholders here, not purely policymakers working in an administrative capacity?
Sure. Although I do want to start with policymakers because
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, absolutely. I just want to think about those folks that are
all of them.
fighting to protect. Anyway, you know what I'm saying.
So let me start with, and this is a, I think this is the message for activists and for policymakers. Ambition matters. One of the reasons we got catalytic technology is because Congress was willing to set standards even without the technology in existence. They focused not on cost, not on feasibility, but on public health. What are we going to do to clean up the environment so that people can breathe clean air? And the idea is that we're going to spur the technological innovation that will get us there. And that's exactly what happened. So ambition matters. And so for advocates advocating, be ambitious. For policymakers making policy, be ambitious. I think the Inflation Reduction Act was ambitious. I think it had those sorts of ambitions in mind. Let's throw a lot of money at innovation and get technology to drive down greenhouse gas emissions across every sector. So I think that's one lesson. Another lesson is the public really matters. And you can see it countless times in the history of cleaning up Los Angeles air, starting with groups like Stamp Out Smog, who really served as a coalition builder for all these other groups. And we're extraordinarily successful in putting pressure on public officials at the local level, at the state level, and ultimately at the federal level. And then we get Mothers of East LA. Mothers of East LA single-handedly changed the narrative about how we think about air pollution from a kind of ambient background narrative to one about who bears the biggest burdens from air pollution. And shockingly, I say that facetiously, those who bear the biggest burdens are those who are least able to fight, right? People of color, people in low-income communities. She didn't always use the words environmental justice, the woman who started Mothers of East LA, but she is the foundational reason we have a strong environmental justice movement in California. And the Air Resources Board and other environmental organizations think about the distributional consequences of their policies. The public pressure really matters. We see it again in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan tries to decimate the Clean Air Act. Extraordinary public support for maintaining it. That matters. And it will matter with respect to climate change. Another lesson, individuals matter. So I think the book is a compilation of a bunch of really heroic people, and they range from ordinary folks who start community organizations to brilliant scientists like a guy named Ari Hagenschmidt, who discovers why we have such a smog problem in Southern California. It's a combination of what comes out of the tailpipes of vehicles and their exposure to sunlight. It turns out to be really a profound discovery and one that gets, of course, dismissed for a long time by vested interests. Mary Nichols, who served on the Air Resources Board in the 1970s and then came back to serve on the Air Resources Board again in the 2000s. Mary Nichols starts her career by filing the very first lawsuit under the Clean Air Act, representing the cities of San Bernardino and Riverside, trying to get the Clean Air Act implemented in as strong a way as possible in Southern California. So their individuals matter. That's a really important message, I think, to activists that a single person actually can change the course of how we address public problems.
Let me ask one follow-up on that. I was talking with an environmental activist here in the Central Valley. Conversation was focused on glyphosate or Roundup, which is a major pollutant in agricultural areas. And we were talking about tactics. And I remember the subject moved to, are there ethical dimensions to how you communicate science and how you use things like fear to encourage behavior? Because as our media landscape is fragmented, we have a lot of misinformation. And so sometimes I think, and I see this happen where environmental activists, in order to kind of stoke energy, will use fear and tactics that maybe aren't the best, but they're trying to deal with an emergency. So how do you think about the use of tactics and how activists communicate and how they discuss problems, given both the decline in literacy, but also the fragmentation of media?
Yeah, I think the media fragmentation is a really complicated one, but I will just give you some examples from our history that I think were quite powerful. One is the Mother's Vista Lake taking baby carriages across the bridge from East Los Angeles into downtown Los Angeles to focus on who is harmed by environmental pollution. I thought that was just symbolically incredibly powerful. The Stamp Out Smog folks used to bring kids wearing gas masks to meetings. Again, just the visual was so powerful. It wasn't misleading. It was just powerful, and it made a huge difference. And then it's important to note that there was a lot of scientific information, misinformation in those days too. So after Ari Hagenschmidt demonstrated in very sophisticated scientific journals that cars were the principal source of smog, he was attacked by the oil industry and they denied the connection. Automobile companies didn't actually attack him. They just ignored him. They just pretended that his research didn't exist. And then they engaged in delay tactics. And then ultimately they engaged in deception. They engaged in antitrust violations where they kept pollution control technology off the market. So the misinformation is not new, and it's hard to know exactly what to do about it. But this is, again, where persistence, individual integrity, Ari Hagenschmidt, not only does he continue to plow away and continue to publish articles, he ultimately becomes the first chair of the California regulatory body that issues the first emission standards. So he puts his money where his mouth is, and he gets the last laugh. He's the one who ultimately first begins to regulate the automobile companies that had been ignoring his research and denying the connection between their product and smog. So that doesn't fully answer the question. I do think we're in a world right now, there's a combination of bots coming from overseas that are dividing us, social media that spreads information so rapidly you can't even keep up with it. That's different than the days of three major television stations and the newspaper of record in Southern California being read by virtually everybody. But it isn't as though we haven't faced incredible opposition on environmental questions from very powerful interests before. Another good example is the guy who discovered that the lead in gasoline was permeating the atmosphere was attacked by the Ethel Corporation and almost had his reputation destroyed. Ultimately, he was proven right, but he was attacked. So these are not new tactics, and they require us to be some combination of incredibly vigilant, incredibly focused on the truth, really important to have good journalism. A good example of this in the context of climate change is a Columbia Journalism Project combined with the Los Angeles Times, showing that the oil industry knew about climate change and was modeling the harms from climate change that were likely to occur if we continued to pollute the atmosphere with greenhouse gases, and then subsequently engaged in a campaign of dis and misinformation to persuade the public that climate change either isn't real or isn't a big deal. That's independent journalism, really important. So I don't have all the answers, but it's not a new problem.
Yeah. When that was the project you mentioned about the oil industry, that was a previous guest, one of the writers on that project. So that was a fantastic story to tell. Okay, a few more questions to wrap up. I'm just, it's annoying to bring it up, but I have to bring it up. The abundance agenda. How does that fit within kind of your vision of government's role? I have seen those horror stories of multiple layers of EIRs or environmental impact reports for something microscopic. I know biologists that work on the high-speed rail that monitor bird movements. You've heard those stories. That's not the broad swath of what environmental regulation is there for. Those stories get propped up. I'm curious if you think there's alignment with, in some dimension, between the goal of abundance, which is getting more stuff done while also protecting the environment while we do it.
Yes, the best example is green energy and green technology. We have decided under this president to cede our leadership on those questions to China. California continues to lead on venture capital being invested in green technology and so forth. But it is completely consistent with abundance to want energy that comes from the sun and from wind, vehicles that are propelled by electricity that's renewable. That's technology. The catalytic converter is the private sector using the brain power of engineers and scientists to solve a problem that government needs to nudge. We know that environmental problems don't get solved by the private sector. There are very clear economic incentives that are not aligned with environmental protection, but government can incentivize technological development. And that's what the Inflation Reduction Act was all about. It was all about saying, we know that greenhouse gases come from the cement industry. We know that there is possible technological development from focusing on hydrogen. We know that we need to produce batteries, and it would be great to produce them in the United States. Let's fund all of that. Let's really give a huge boost to creating abundance in a way that is also good for the environment. That is China's entire industrial policy right now. And we have basically decided that we're going to go back to the days of fossil fuel extraction and dirty coal-fired power plants and so forth.
Yeah, no, the future's the whatever that Noah Smith calls that electrical stack. China's busy making every version of a drone, and that's the future. It's not the future is not controlled explosions in traditional automobiles, but that's a whole different subject that we can unpack. I want to return back to California history, which is the focus of this podcast. How did the research on this book change your perspective on California and its history?
That's a good question. I think, and I'm not sure this is a change, but it's a through line that we have had 70 plus years of political leadership that understands that environmental protection is also good politics. So we have yet to have, and I'm not saying this is completely consistent for all time, but even Ronald Reagan, when he was governor, tried to pushed through a regulation that would have required the retrofitting of old cars to make them pollute less. It was actually Jerry Brown who stopped the effort because it was so politically unpopular. So,
Stranger than fiction, right?
stranger than fiction. Of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger came into office as a climate leader and has remained so. And I think one of the big lessons from the book, there are many, I hope, but one lesson is that environmental policy for California has also been good politics. And it's made our state greater and cleaner. And also we're innovators. And that innovation, a lot of that innovation comes from focusing on cleaning up our environment.
So we conclude these podcasts each time with book recommendations. I, whether it's about this subject or things that have interested you or California related or not, what are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners?
The book I'm going to recommend right now is Rebecca Solnit's new book.
Oh, I
So,
just finished it. It was so good. That was, yeah. Say more.
and the reason I recommend it, and I'll let you remind the listeners of the title, is it's hopeful.
Yeah.
And I think in an age where we are feeling despondent and sometimes feeling like there's nothing we can do to change the world, her book is a reminder that's not true and that hope actually propels change. I like to think my book has a similar theme. It's obviously focused on one issue, and that is the cleanup of air pollution. But I think we need optimism right now at a time where it's hard to be optimistic, but where if we resign ourselves to the status quo, if we think that despair is the only appropriate emotion, we're not going to achieve anything.
Yeah, it's funny you brought that book up because I was reading your book and her book at the same time. And the title is The Beginning Comes After the End,
That's right.
Notes on a World of Change. Yeah, I think both of your books are on a similar goal, which is reminding us of where we came from so we can notice the progress so we can be inspired to do the same thing for our future. And yeah, I think on a complete similar path. To close, what are you working on next?
So I'm getting into some very wonky, weedy details in an article that is also meant to be forward-looking, and it is about how to think about what happens if somebody who's interested in tackling climate change takes office, the president of takes the presidency in 2029. How do we respond? What do we do? What do we need to do that's different from what we've been doing in the past? And the reason that I say that is because as I worked on car standards with the Biden administration, I've studied them intensely for more than 20 years. And what we've seen is first, the George W. Bush administration trying to stymie California from issuing standards, then Obama coming in and adopting pretty stringent standards, Trump administration coming in and repealing those standards, Biden administration coming in and issuing stronger standards, Trump too coming in, repealing those standards. That is no way to run a railroad. And I'm trying to figure out what can we be doing differently that gives us more durability, that doesn't allow a president to come in and completely upend the progress that we're trying to make in tackling climate change. So that's my new project.
Okay, so is that more of an academic article or a book project?
It's an academic article, but it's aimed at folks who pay a lot of attention to these issues, not just academics, but regulators and policymakers and so forth. So it's meant to be a somewhat broader audience than the kind of narrow audience that sometimes law review articles attract.
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today.
Sure, it's great. It's a really fun conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.